Chapter 75. Thankfully, the outpouring of religious zeal and Topiltzin's maniacal grab for power did not end in bloodshed. There was no death by misunderstanding. The only real tragedy was that of the young victims who had drowned during the first crossing. Unbound, the massive crowd flowed past the army units and through the streets of Roma toward Gongora Hill. The chanting had faded, and they shouted slogans in the Aztec tongue that all American and most Mexican observers could not comprehend. Topiltzin led the triumphal pilgrimage up the slope of the hill. The Aztec god impostor had carefully planned for his role of deliverer. Seizing the Egyptian treasures would give him the necessary influence and financing to push aside the long-reigning institutional revolutionary party of President De Lorenzo without the inconvenience of a free election. All of Mexico was within 400 meters of falling into Capister family hands. News of his brother's death in Egypt had not yet reached him. His close supporters and advisers had deserted the communications truck during the excitement and missed the urgent message. They walked behind Topiltzin's hand-carried platform, driven by curiosity to see the artifacts. Topiltzin stood erect in a white robe with a jaguar skin cape draped on his shoulders, clutching a raised pole that flew a banner of the eagle and the snake. A forest of portable spotlights were aimed at his platform, bathing him in a multicolored corona. The glare distracted him, and he gestured for some of the lights to sweep the slope ahead. Except for several pieces of heavy equipment, the excavation seemed deserted. None of the army engineers was evident near the crater or the tunnel. Topiltzin didn't like the look of it. He spread his hands as a signal for the advancing mob to halt. The order was repeated through loudspeakers until the forward wall of people slowly came to a stop. Every face turned toward Topiltzin, reverently awaiting his next command. Suddenly, a banshee-like wail rose from the summit of the hill and increased in volume until its shrill pitch forced the crowd to cover their ears with their hands. Then an array of strobe lights sparkled and flashed across the sea of faces. A light display with the magical dazzle of the northern lights danced in the night sky. The people stood rooted, gazing entranced at the extraordinary sight. The light show grew to an indescribable intensity while the shriek whipped the air around the countryside with the eerie timbre of a soundtrack from a science fiction movie. Together, the flashing lights and the eerie sounds built to a breathtaking crescendo. And then the strobe lights went out, and the silence struck with stunning abruptness. For a full minute, the sound rang in everyone's ears, and the lights skyrocketed in their eyes. Then an unseen light source very slowly highlighted a lone figure of a man standing on the peak of the hill. The effect was startling. The light rays shimmered and glistened off metallic objects surrounding his body. When the man was fully revealed, he was seen to be wearing the fighting gear of an ancient Roman legionary. He wore a burgundy tunic under a polished iron cuirass. The helmet on his head and the greaves protecting his shins were shined to a high gloss. A gladius, a double-edged sword, hung at his side, clasped to a leather sling that went over the opposite shoulder. One arm held an oval shield, while the opposite hand gripped an upright pilum thrusting spear. Topiltzin stared with curious fascination. A game? A joke? A theatrical hoax? What were the Americans scheming now? His immense horde of believers stood in hushed silence and stared at the Roman as if he were a phantom. Then they slowly turned back to Topiltzin, waiting expectantly for their messiah to make the first move. A bluff born of desperation, he decided finally. The Americans were playing their last card in an effort to block his superstitious, dirt-poor followers from approaching the treasures. "Could be a trick to kidnap and hold you as a hostage," said one of his nearby advisers. There was contemptuous speculation in Topiltzin's eyes. A trick, yes, but a kidnap, no. The Americans know this mob would go to a rampage if I was threatened. The ploy is transparent. Except for the envoy whose skin I sent back to Washington, I've denied all appeals for talks with their State Department officials. This theatrical production is simply a clumsy attempt at a final face-to-face negotiation. I'd be interested to learn what offer they've thrown on the table. Without uttering another word and without listening to further warnings from his advisers, he ordered the platform lowered to the ground and he stepped off. The spotlights stayed on him as he advanced up the hill alone and arrogant. His feet did not show beneath the hem of his robe, and he appeared to glide rather than walk. He moved at a measured pace, fingering a holstered Colt Python 357 revolver on a belt under his robe, checking that the safety catch was off. He also kept one hand on an orange smoke bomb in case he required a visual effect to screen a quick escape. He approached until he could clearly see that the figure in the Roman legionary costume was a department store mannequin. It wore an insipid smile, and the painted eyes stared blankly into nothingness. The plaster hands and face were faded and chipped. An unmistakable curiosity spread on Topiltzin's face as he studied the dummy, but there was also a look of wariness. He was sweating freely, and the white robe had wrinkled and gone limp. Then a tall man in range boots, denims, and a white turtleneck sweater stepped into the spotlights from behind a thicket of mesquite. He peered through opaline green eyes that were as cold as an Arctic ice floe. He stopped when he stood beside the mannequin. Topiltzin felt he had the advantage. He wasted no time. He spoke first in English. "What did you hope to gain with the dummy and the light show?" "Your attention. My compliments. You were successful. Now if you'll kindly relate your government's message." The stranger stared at him for a long moment. "Anybody ever tell you your outfit looks like a bedsheet the day after a college fraternity toga party?" Topiltzin's expression hardened. "Did your president hope to insult me by sending a clown?" "I believe this is where I'm supposed to say, it takes one to know one." "You have 1 minute to state your case." He paused and made a sweeping gesture with his hand. "Before I order my people to resume their march." Pitt turned to the rear of the hill and looked questioningly toward the many kilometers of dark, open country. "March where?" Topiltzin ignored the remark. "You can begin with your name, your title, and function in the American bureaucracy." "My name is Dirk Pitt. My title is Mr. Pitt. My function is United States taxpayer, and you can go straight to hell." Topiltzin's eyes blazed darkly. "Men have died horribly for showing disrespect to one who speaks directly to the gods." Pitt smiled with the bored unconcern of the devil being threatened by a television evangelist. "If we have to talk, let's cut out the hype and hot air. You've misled the poor of Mexico with stage gimmicks while promising them new lifestyles over the rainbow you can't possibly deliver. You're a fraud. From top to bottom, you're a fraud. So don't talk down to me. I'm not one of your garbage pickers. I'm not impressed with criminal scum like Robert Capistere." Capistere opened his mouth, then snapped it shut. He took a step backward, surprise showing in his eyes, unable to fully believe what he'd heard. Seconds passed while he stared at Pitt. At last he spoke in a hoarse whisper. "How much do you know?" "Enough," Pitt replied casually. "The Capistere family and their slimy business are the talk of Washington. Champagne corks popped all over the White House when word came in about your greased brother, the one who thinks he's a Muslim prophet. Poetic justice, him getting killed by the terrorist he hired to hijack the Lady Flamborough and murder the passengers." "My brother..." Capistere could not spit out the word, dead. "I don't believe you." "You didn't know?" Pitt asked, mildly surprised. "I talked to him less than 24 hours ago," Topiltzin said adamantly. "Paul Ahmad Yazid is alive and well." "A walking corpse is not one of his better imitations." "What do you or your government hope to gain by these lies?" Pitt stared at Capistere coldly. "I'm glad you brought that up. The idea here is to save the Alexandria Library treasures, and we can't very well do that if you unleash your groupies inside the depository chamber. They'll steal whatever artifacts they think they can sell to buy or trade for food, and destroy what they don't value, especially the precious books and scrolls." "They will not enter," Capistere said firmly. "You think you can stop them?" "My followers do what I command." "The books and artworks have to be catalogued and surveyed by qualified archaeologists and historians," Pitt said. "If you want any concessions from Washington, you must guarantee the library will be treated as a scientific project." Capistere's eyes searched Pitt's for a moment. He slowly came back on balance and straightened to his full height. He was 10 centimeters shorter than Pitt. He stood there wavering like a cobra about to strike. Then he spoke in a voice deep, toneless, and menacing. "I do not have to make guarantees, Mr. Pitt. There will be no bargaining for concessions here. Your military failed to turn back my people at the river. The momentum is mine. The Egyptian treasures are mine. The entire southwestern states." His eyes blazed at Pitt with the look of a maniac.
will also be mine. My brother Paul will rule Egypt. Our younger brother will someday head the government of Brazil. That is why I am here. That is why you are here as the lone defender of a world superpower in one final pathetic attempt to negotiate. But your government has nothing left to negotiate. And if any attempt is made to stop our removal of the treasure to Mexico, I shall order it all burned and destroyed. I have to give you credit, Capister, Pitt muttered in disgust. You think big. A pity you're allowed to run loose. You could make up a fifth Napoleon for a poker game in an asylum. Irritation flickered at the edge of Capister's eyes. Goodbye, Mr. Pitt. My patience is exhausted. I will genuinely enjoy sacrificing you to the gods and sending your flayed skin to the White House. Forgive me for not having any decorative tattoos. Capister found Pitt's free and easy indifference unnerving. No one had ever talked down to him before. He turned and raised a hand toward the hushed mass of people. Don't you think you should inventory your new wealth before you turn it over to them? Pitt asked. Think of the world abuse that will be heaped on you for allowing your drones to trash Alexander the Great's golden casket. Capister's hand slowly dropped. There was a flush at his temples. What are you saying? Alexander's casket exists? And so do his remains. Pitt motioned toward the excavated tunnel. Would you like a guided tour before you throw open the storage chamber to your adoring public? Capister nodded. With his back to the crowd, he slipped the Colt revolver from the belt beneath his robe and held it out of sight under a loose draped sleeve. His other hand gripped the smoke bomb. The slightest move by you or anyone hidden inside the tunnel to harm me, and I will blow your spine in two. Why would I possibly want to harm you? Pitt asked with mock innocence. Where are the engineers who were working the excavation? Every man who could carry a gun was sent to the defense line at the river. The lie seemed to satisfy Capister. Raise your shirt and drop your pants below your boots. In front of all these people? Pitt asked, smiling. I want to see if you're armed or wired for sound. Pitt pulled his turtleneck above his shoulders and lowered the denims to his ankles. There was no sign of a hidden transmitter or gun on his body or inside his boots. Satisfied? Topiltzen nodded. He waved the gun toward the shaft entrance. You lead, I'll follow. Mind if I carry the dummy inside? The weapons he's holding are real artifacts. You can leave them just inside the entrance. Then Capister turned and waved a signal to his advisers that all was safe. Pitt rearranged his clothing, removed the weapons from the mannequin, and entered the shaft. The roof was slightly less than 2 meters high, and Pitt had to duck under the support beams as he walked. He deposited the spear and sword, but kept the shield, placing it over his head as if to ward off falling rock. Knowing the shield was as useless as a sheet of cardboard against rounds from a .357 Magnum handgun, Topiltzen made no protest. The shaft sloped sharply down for 12 meters and then leveled off. The passage was lit by a string of lights that hung from the beams. The army engineers had cut the walls and floor almost perfectly flat, so the going was easy. The only discomfort was the stuffy air and the dust that rose in swirls from their footsteps. "Are you receiving sound and picture, Mr. President?" asked General Chandler. "Yes, General," answered the President. "Their conversation is coming in quite clear. But they walked out of camera range when they entered the tunnel. We'll pick them up again in the casket chamber, where we have another concealed camera." "How is Pitt wired?" asked Martin Brogan. "The microphone and transmitter are inserted in the front seam of the old shield." "Is he armed?" "We don't believe so." All those in the Situation Room became silent as their eyes moved to a second monitor that was displaying the excavated chamber under Gongora Hill. The camera was focused on a gold coffin raised in the center of the chamber. But not all eyes were on the second monitor. One pair had not left the first. "Who was that?" Nichols blurted. Brogan's eyes narrowed. "What do you mean?" Nichols pointed at the monitor whose camera was still aimed at the underground entrance of the hill. A shadow passed in front of the camera and moved into the tunnel. "I didn't see anything," said General Metcalf. "I missed it too," the President agreed. He leaned toward the microphone sitting on the table in front of him. "General Chandler?" "Mr. President," the General replied swiftly. "Dale Nichols swears he saw someone enter the tunnel after Pitt and Topiltzen." One of my aides thought he caught someone, too. So I'm not seeing things, Nichols sighed. Do you have any idea who it might be? Whoever it was, Chandler said, alarm showing on his face, he wasn't one of ours.